Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custy. On this program, I will be talking to Baltimoreans of renown who have been successful in their craft outside the shores of the Chesapeake Bay. Today, my guest is Kevin Kilner. Kevin is the son of Dorothea, an elementary school teacher, and Edward Kilner, who worked in advertising, sales, and insurance. He made his first television appearance on an episode of The Cosby Show in 1989. He's perhaps best known for playing the main protagonist in the first season of Earth Final Conflict. He starred opposite Nancy Travis in Almost Perfect, and he appeared in Joss Whedon's show Dial House. Kevin is an alumnus of Delaney High School and Johns Hopkins University. While attending Johns Hopkins, he was a member of the national champion lacrosse team. His films include A Cinderella Story, Raising Helen, Cut and Run, Autofocus, American Pie 2, TheBrainiacs.com, My Mother the Spy, Home Alone 3, and Smart House. On the stage, he was in Lemon Sky off-Broadway, Dinner with Friends, and on Broadway, The Glass Menagerie, where he won a Theater World Award. Welcome, Kevin.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So let's start about growing up in Baltimore. Tell us how you did that.
Well, I was born in the city and lived in the city until I was about 4 years old. This is like early '60s, and then my folks wanted to move us out to the country. They wanted their kids to grow up in a more rural setting, so we moved out to Jacksonville, Maryland, when it was rural in the '60s, and then later on to Moncton, Maryland. And they rented a farmhouse out there for, I don't know, a decade, I guess, or so. I went to school out there. So a lot of it was, in those days, it was so rural that, I had friends whose fathers had farms, and you'd help them, cut hay, bale hay, straw, it was just really kind of more bucolic than it certainly is now before so many of the farmers sold out and a lot of development happened.
Is that way up Delaney Valley Road we're talking about?
Yeah, it is. It's well north of Lock Raven Reservoir. Jacksonville used to be called Four Corners. It had literally had like four gas stations, a pharmacy, a hardware store, a restaurant, and oddly, a grocery store, and oddly, a toy store. And this is years and years ago. I mean, a big deal in those days literally was the bookmobile would come out on Wednesday nights. And I remember my sister and I vividly remember, used to park on an area near a dirt football field that, my sister and I would have contests as to how many books we could take out and read. And, you're getting your books off the back of a bus,
right.
Bookmobile. So it was very quaint. And my mom was a fine arts major at University of Maryland, and where she had met my dad when he had come back from, he had been wounded fighting in Korea and come back over, and he was on the GI Bill going to the University of Maryland. So he had just gotten out of the Marine Corps, and they were out there. Mom was painting, and my dad was actually helping and doing the business side of her painting. She got represented in like 20 different dress shops, small boutique shops with her. She would do everything from flatware to jewelry to watercolors. And then I guess they weren't making enough money. And it was kind of solitary environment. She wanted to be around children. She'd always thought about teaching. So she went back to Towson State, which then Towson State Teachers College in those days. And now it's, wonderful Towson University, but it was, she got her teaching degree there, her master's degree, and then she got the equivalent of her doctorate, and ended up teaching for 5 years in an Episcopal school, and then another 25 years in the Baltimore County public school system. And
was this in the mid '60s that she went back to Towson?
She went back. Yeah, she was there. Wow. In
she might have been the same time as my mother. My mother went back in 1966. Was an English major, English lit.
They were absolutely there at the same time because my sister and I were, I'd say my sister and I were, between 5 and 9. So that would mean it was anywhere from 63 to 67. She was there. And at any rate, she was trying to, get into a more regular gig. And so, it was great. My it was just my sister and I, and we ended up going, we went to St. Paul, St. James up in Moncton, and then St. Paul's for a couple of years, and then we both ended up going to Delaney, and we both graduated from there, and my sister went on to Georgetown, and I went on to Johns Hopkins.
Another coincidence, I went to Maryvale.
There you go.
Yeah. In grade school, everybody says, oh, it's a girl's school. No, not grade school at that time. Grade school was co-ed right next to you guys at St. Paul's.
There you go. Yeah. Wow.
We might have passed each other and just kind of gave each other mean looks or something back in the 60s.
Well, you know, I've always loved that aspect of Baltimore because it's always felt more like a town to me where everybody's connected to everybody. I mean, maybe there's two, three, no more than 4 degrees of separation between people in Baltimore and that area. And you know, that was one of the great things, I think, growing up in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s. You know, you just felt that Baltimore was very – had more of a town feel than a huge city, a huge metropolis feel.
Yeah,
and having lived in New York and Los Angeles the bulk of my adult life, you know, and then you realize how big a city can really be.
Yeah.
And believe me, it's no blessing. I mean, I think that it's kind of great that Baltimore still has that town feel that, you know, everybody sort of knows someone who knows someone, and we're all connected, you know.
Yeah, I always appreciated that about Baltimore, too. It's funny, though. It is a small world. I was living in Northern Ireland for 10 years up to a year ago. And I saw an ad in a paper, and they were looking to start a softball team, of all places, Northern Ireland. So I thought, why not? So I got to play in a few games, and I was just talking to this guy on another team, and we were talking, and he said, yeah, I'm Baltimore. I'm from, I forget where he was from, but he said, I grew up mostly in Baltimore. And it turned out that, like me, he went to Calvert Hall about 15 years later than me, but he went to Calvert Hall, and this guy, you know, 5,000 miles away in another country, all of a sudden he just happened to walk up to him. But it's like that. I mean, there's Baltimoreans all over the world, and that's what hopefully I'll reach with this radio station.
I couldn't agree more, and especially, you know, I found the Baltimoreans who, like, went to Johns Hopkins or even went to the University of Maryland. I mean, you know, I've met more Baltimoreans out here in the film and television industry out in Los Angeles, as well as Baltimoreans in New York, and or, you know, New Yorkers who became Baltimoreans and then went back to New York after a period of time of working in Baltimore. It's, you know, Maryland is, and with the whole Washington, D.C. influence. I mean, my dad used to always say that the state of Maryland was like a miniature United States, a very sophisticated place. And, you know, you had the hills, and the mountains in the west, and the hills in the north, and the flatlands in the east, and down to the ocean, and Washington, D.C., and, you know, everything in between, including, like, Columbia, and a lot of, you know, you think of James Rouse. I mean, there are a lot of sophisticated people who live in Maryland and highly educated and traveled the world and lived all over the world. So I'm not surprised when I run into people from Baltimore and from Maryland, everywhere in my industry, in Los Angeles and New York. I've run into people repeatedly. I know a bunch of people that live, you know, out here, transplanted Marylanders. So
that's true. It's also a microcosm of the world too. You have Little Italy. You have a big Polish area down here in East Baltimore and
Highlandtown.
It's just
my mom. Her parents grew up in Highlandtown. My mom was German-Polish, so we knew Highlandtown well, you know. In fact, they changed their name from Swiskowski to Swiss to, you know, get around a lot of the prejudice back in the day when they came over from my grandfather, my mom's dad from Poland. But her mother was from Germany, and so that whole east side of Baltimore. And then my dad was from the west side of Baltimore where a lot of the Irish and English-Irish were, and so, yeah.
Where did he grow up in West Baltimore?
Catonsville. Yeah, Catonsville area. So my mom, her dad was an attorney and moved them out to Glenarm years later. But she went to Notre Dame and then the University of Maryland. My dad went to Poly, and then he went on to the Marine Corps, and then he went to the University of Maryland. So
then after St. Paul's, you went to Delaney?
Yeah, my mom was teaching in Timonium at the time, and because she was a teacher, she could, one of the perks, they allowed teachers to send their their children any public high school they wanted to in Baltimore County. And at the time, Delaney not only made sense geographically because it was right next door to where she taught, literally like less than a quarter of a mile down the road practically, but Delaney was very strong academically. I remember in 1976 when I graduated, we had 10 national merit scholars. In the next, the second place high school in the entire state was Gilman with 9. So, and those were the days that, you know, and I think they still do this. I mean, Delaney students were being bused down to Johns Hopkins for, you know, computer classes and things like that. So it was a very, you know, progressive public high school at the time.
So what about you? Were you a good student at Delaney?
You know, I guess I was. I mean, it was on the Honor Society. My senior year, I was the scholar athlete for the school. You know, went to the Heroes Banquet. You know, it was a goal of mine. I had wanted to be, by my senior year, I wanted to be the scholar athlete of the school. It was just a goal that I set for myself and, had to achieve it. And, you know, it's funny, these days I don't think I would get into Johns Hopkins just because the requirements have become stricter and the bar higher and higher and higher. But I guess in those days, you know, I did well enough to get into Hopkins. And, you know, I had always dreamed of playing lacrosse there since my dad took me to a game at Homewood Field when I was about 7 or 8. And my eyes were the size of saucers. I couldn't believe. You could feel the tradition and how, you know, great a team they were. And, you know, so that was another goal of mine was I wanted to go.
So did you play lacrosse at Delaney then?
Yeah.
What were your sports that you played at Delaney?
My senior year in 76, Delaney had always lost to Bill Thomas, the legendary Bill Thomas, who was the father of Jack Thomas, who's the Hall of Fame lacrosse player and great All-American from Johns Hopkins. Bill Thomas was the head coach of Towson, and Towson High School had the finest lacrosse in the 1960s and 70s.
Okay, for Towson years, it was Towson. Jeez.
They had finer lacrosse than the prep schools, and they were consistently in the top five every year in this entire state. And my senior year in 1976 was the first time Delaney ever beat Towson.
Really?
We beat him 12-5 at Towson, and it was Bill Thomas's last game as a coach. I think he retired after that game, after teaching and coaching for probably, I want to guess, 30-some years. And I remember at the end of the game, I had a pretty good game. I had like 3 goals and 5 assists. And, you know, I mean, at the end of the game, I had thought about that. I knew it was his last game. I knew it was my last game. If we lost, it was certainly going to be my last game because Towson would have gone on to the county championship game against Randallstown, which we did instead. We beat Randallstown, and we went on to the state championship against Arundel, and we beat Arundel, and we won the state AAA championship my senior year.
Well done.
But I gave Thomas my mom had found a small – in an antique shop, she had found a small little bear. His nickname was the Bear. She found this little bear that had like a little, you know, hidden compartment for a little bit of liquor. And I gave it to him as a, you know, as a gift. I mean, maybe it was an inappropriate gift now that I think of it, you know, maybe he was on the wagon or something, but I shook his hand and I told him, I said, I greatly respect what you've done for the game and I want to give you this. And, I don't know, there was a crazy number. I remember the game, there must've been 2,000 to 3,000 people at that game. They were on the field and actually on the field. Every time a ball used to go near the sideline, they'd have to like run backwards to get away from it. So, because they were on the field, ringing the field, you know, that game. But it was very memorable playing, you know, I played football and I ran indoor track and I, you know, played lacrosse. But, and I guess I got recruited for football and lacrosse from various schools like Naval Academy and Bucknell, Washington Lee. But I really, you know, when I got in there and they wanted me to play lacrosse, that was, you know, that
was. Was that your first choice, I guess, then, Hopkins?
Yeah, it was my first choice. And Henry Ciccarone was the head lacrosse coach then, and he was already a bit of a legend, and he was building something. He had not yet won. Bob Scott had retired in 1975 or 76, and Chick's first year, I think, was 76. And then we, or maybe 70, it might have been 75, but at any rate, Hopkins won the national championship in 74. I think Mr. Thomas retired. Mr. Scott retired then. Bob Scott retired then. And Chick took over. And so 75 was a tough year. I think Maryland won then. And 76 was the first time Cornell won. And 77 was the second. Cornell won its second national championship. And they beat us my freshman year. And they beat us badly down in Virginia and Charlottesville. They were beating us 10-1 at halftime. I'll never forget it. And they ended up winning 16-8. And then my sophomore year, I had shattered a thumb and was just on the practice squad because I needed a couple of steel pins to heal it. And, you know, by the time I came back, I was redshirting. But
so it was on the team. Just to back up a little bit, when you were a freshman, were you playing on varsity?
Yeah, I was playing on varsity. Wow. Sitting on the bench, but playing on the varsity and, you know, paying my dues and learning. And then my sophomore year, I shattered the thumb and, but playing, you know, and then, we beat Cornell for our first of our three. We beat them at Rutgers 13-8. It might've been 12-5. It wasn't, or 12-7, something like that. It wasn't that close. And then, 79, my sophomore year, we beat the University of Maryland. That was our first undefeated season. And we beat University of Maryland something like 15-9 down at College Park. But it wasn't even that close. It was like 15-6. And then they scored like the last three goals. And then the third time we won was the overtime win against the University of Virginia up at Cornell. And that was in 1980. And then my senior – I went out and worked at Black & Decker Corporation in the fall of my senior year. I had enough credits, and I was just going to go back in the spring to play and try and win a fourth one. And we ended up losing to the University of North Carolina 14-13 in a game that was extremely controversial because the referees called back three of our goals,
really?
Including one that clearly went right over Tom, the goalie, North Carolina goalie's shoulder. Went through the net, tore a hole through the net.
And they called it back.
Yeah, they called that one back. They called two others back. The one that supposedly did not break the plane of the goal was a score between the first and the second quarter. And then they said, you know, that the time had expired just as the guy shot the ball. And then that same thing happened between the third and the fourth quarter. As the third quarter was ending, guy shot the ball, scored. They said, no, it happened. It didn't break the plane until after. So we thought a lot of people had it in for us because just wanted a different champion because it sort of, and it was a very tough. And then there's a picture in Sports Illustrated of one of my teammates, Joe Saletti, sticking his arm through the hole in the net over Tommy Sears' shoulder that the ball was shot
hard. It ripped that through. It went right through.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, that was a tough pill to swallow because we thought we clearly had beaten them and, you know, they just wanted – a change, we thought, you know. But at any rate, it was a great experience. It was great playing for Chick, Henry Ciccaroni, and you know, the assistant coaches were Freddie Smith and Tony McCarthy and Joe Callen. And, you know, early on was, you know, Dennis Townsend and some other people who were wonderful. But the, you know, the real motor and the real genius was Henry Ciccaroni, who, you know, was just a great, great lacrosse coach and had us at a level of excellence that's very interesting. I always say it's the greatest class I took at Johns Hopkins was playing on that team because you learn more about life and human behavior from being in the crucible and the pressure cooker of, you know, each year it got exponentially harder to climb that mountain and beat, you know, everybody and win it again.
Right.
And we were the first modern team to win. And by modern, I think what I mean is in 1971, they started the NCAA playoffs. And in the old days, it was, originally it might have been eight teams that they chose and they got down to the national championship and through a bracket system. And then it went to 16. I think today it's above 16, but you know, it's very difficult. Yeah. You know, it's extremely difficult to be, to, you know, keep a level of excellence that high And when you have turnover within the organization, because each year you're graduating seniors and you put new people in, and, you know, to maintain a level of excellence, I mean, it was the greatest class I ever took. You know, it was.
And you were part of it. Yeah. What year were you national champions? Were you a senior then?
78, 79, 80. So technically my sophomore, junior, and senior year. And then I had the extra year to play because the 78 year I was literally on the practice squad because of the being redshirted. Mm. I always say to people, you know, I was a good player in high school. I was an All Metro and All American in high school, but at Hopkins I was a very average player. I mean, I played with really great players. I'd say easily it's over a half a dozen now. I don't know how there might be eight guys that I played with now who are in the Lacrosse Hall of Fame. Michael Federico, Mark Greenberg. Mark Greenberg was the first defenseman in the history of the game to be named the most valuable player in the nation because he became the first offensive defenseman. I mean, we would literally shut off the other players, like stand so close to them. And Greenberg was so good, he could literally take the ball away from anybody. And he became our best offensive weapon. Federico was the three-time first-team All-American goalie and was the dominant goalie of his era. Brendan Schneck, Michael O'Neill was one of the greatest Hopkins attackmen ever. Brendan Schneck, one of the greatest midfielders and attackmen ever. Jeff Cook, who sadly died about 2 years ago, was the first of my teammates to die, of our teammates to die. He died suddenly at age 50. He was a three-time All-American. He's in the Hall of Fame. You know, David Huntley, Hot Rod Huntley, in the Hall of Fame. You know, really, really phenomenal players who defined their positions at the time and were the bar for excellence at the time, you know.
Hopkins was the place to go.
My freshman year was a very, very rough transition, and I was a pretty miserable person because it's hard going from being the big fish in the pond, in a little pond, to being a little fish in a very big pond. And the transition from high school to college, I mean, the game is exponentially faster, quicker, and tougher. And I was not having an easy time. They were moving me from playing attack to midfield, and I had to learn how to play defense and, you know, be a midfielder. And I wasn't too pleased. And I was so miserable at one point. I was making my family very miserable. My dad said to me, he said, you know, transfer, you know, if you want, if you're this unhappy, you know, get out, transfer. And I said, no. And he said, well, then you got to change your attitude. You sure you don't want to transfer? I said, no, because I know we're going to win national championships, and I want to be on a national championship win team. I said, being on an NCAA championship winning team is more important to me than being an All-American at some Division III school or going to another Division I school and being that big man. Okay, I want to win a championship. That's why you play team sports. So I'd rather be an average player, which is what I was, a very average player. You know, I played defensive midfielder and, you know, didn't score a lot and, you know, became a defensive specialist, which was odd. And but it didn't matter to me. I mean, I was with a great group of guys. It demanded excellence, were very tough and very, you know, committed. And we did it, you know. And to this day, I'm more proud of being a part of that than if I had gone off and, you know.
Yeah, it's good that you stayed on. But it's amazing, too, that you remember all these names and what's happened to all the guys and such like that, too.
Well, lacrosse is a blood sport. You know, there are certain sports. I mean, I'm not taking anything away from any other team sport, but, you know, lacrosse is a very physical sport, and it gets kind of violent at times, and certainly you do spill blood. I mean, everything from, you know, getting teeth knocked out to, you know, chipped to whatever and stitches and blah, blah, blah. And you know, short of the kind of bonding that happens in the military and warfare, which is at a whole other level, much higher level, sports that are contact sports, that are blood sports, you know, there's a real brotherhood there. And you have to have each other's backs because literally someone could, you know, give you a concussion at any moment. So it is a brotherhood, and it's not in any way being braggadocio you know, you are a brotherhood because you have to trust each other. That's one of the things that you learn. You have to learn how to almost intimately trust someone is going to be there to back you up. And I mean back up on field, you know, when you get beaten and someone has to slide on your guy and take care of you and cover your position, or you have to cover their position, and you have to work in concert. So when the ball is moving properly in a game of lacrosse, just like the flow of soccer or basketball, it's almost a beautiful ballet. It's literally reaches a level of artistry where you say, my God, the ball could not have moved more efficiently and as if they were one living organism. And, you know, you reach those places rarely. But when you do, the high, the adrenal rush is so high that you kind of go, wow, this is why we do this. Let's do this again. Let's try and figure out how we get to that place again. And that creates a kind of chemical brotherhood that, you know, we still get together once a year. And the guys, the fellas. So
well, I can understand then how you went into acting, because it's a similar mix of technique with skill, of learning the technique and learning the skill to rely on fellow actors and such.
I think that's extremely well observed on your part, Dave, seriously, without blowing smoke, because, you know, I got out, I graduated in those days. I didn't know anybody was in the arts or anything like that. So I went to work at First National Bank of Maryland, which some people may remember and the older people will remember. And I was a credit analyst and worked singularly alone in a cubicle and, you know, occasionally got reviewed. And then I became a loan officer, a commercial loan officer to Fortune 500 companies in the mid-Atlantic states. And, you know, you worked more in teamwork way then. But I really wanted to work with groups of people in a way that was a more singularly committed, emotional way. And, you know, when I was a banker and a businessman, which I was for a little under – or actually right around 3 years, because I went into the mortgage banking business. I became an office manager after I left First National. The thing I was missing in the business world was a kind of emotional commitment that you got from playing in sports. And – you know, I love to write, and I thought a lot about it. And I took a lot of – I went back to Hopkins at night, and I took a couple semesters of fiction writing and a couple semesters of journalism because I thought I wanted to write. But I then took an acting class at the an adult evening acting class in downtown Baltimore, taught by someone who was had a reoccurring role in a soap opera in New York and advertised in one of the free newspapers you see on the, you know, the city blocks in Baltimore. And when I took that class, I got bitten immediately because you had to work with your scene partner. And I thought, wow. And if there are other people in the play or the screenplay, then, you know, you're working, you know, just like in sports, you're one unit, one cog of a whole, and you got to tell the story by everybody doing their job properly or at their best level. You can tell the story in a captivating and memorable way. Just as in sports, if everybody does their job well and at their optimum level, then you can capture a championship. So I think I was trying to replicate that. I think that's very well observed.
There were other streams when in Hopkins, and you weren't only just on a great team, but a team that has to live up to previous years of excellence, too. And that must have been incredible pressure on all you guys. Especially you're 20 years old or something like that, too, you know? You're just you're 20 years old. Right? You're just basically kids yourself.
Yeah, I think that's really well observed. Again, except for, like, I'm trying to think of other stress-filled jobs. Any other stress-filled job that a 20-something might hold, I have a lot of family in the military, so I think of, you know, being in a military in a life-and-death situation. But in sports, when you play at a very high level, you're in a kind of situation where you have to perform, and there's tens of thousands of people potentially watching you. And so the transition for me from sports into stage and being in front of a camera, you know, I was already used to the pressure, and it didn't feel like, yeah, of course my heart races and I still have nerves, but I had sort of been training because I've been playing sports competitively since I was 7, and I had been fortunate enough to play on some championship teams in 6th and 7th and 8th grade and even 9th grade, I played on a championship team, lacrosse team. And so I played on championship teams my entire career. And so you're right. I was, you know, I was used to people watching me on a stage. Maybe that was a field, you know, with grass. But, I was used to it. And so it didn't freeze me or freak me out to make an entrance from stage left or for a director in front of a camera to say action and – you know, you got 100 people watching you and you're outdoors and you're losing the sun and you got to get this scene in one take or two takes. And, you know, yeah, I'm just used to the pressure already. And I don't, there's no ego in saying that. That was just a matter of circumstances, but I say well observed by you because in a way I was sort of preparing to become an actor and didn't know it.
Right. Well, you scanned over being a credit analyst at First National Bank. What was your major at Hopkins?
My degree is in social and behavioral sciences, but my emphasis was economics. So I was being very, very practical and preparing, you know, for a life of a businessman.
But isn't that interesting that with all these sports that you played championship seasons, and you know, it was all teamwork and people relied on you and you relied on them, that one of the first jobs you have is you by yourself in a cubicle.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I was literally in that cubicle absolutely no more than 2 months when I realized I had made a massive, huge mistake. And, you know, part of me, I will say this is why I've always liked or thought that I would perhaps have taken a crack at journalism or something. Part of me loves the detective work, the digging, preparing for a role. The research is fun to me, and the digging for answers and clues as to how people did what they did and, you know, understanding the facts of a story or a character. Or in this case, a corporation, you know, tearing apart a financial report. There's aspects of it that are kind of interesting, you know, intellectually. But, you know, I didn't. If that's the bulk of your day, that wasn't such a, you know, I like doing that part of the time, but not fully.
Certainly wasn't a career move for you.
No. And you know, I got really scared and really depressed because I realized I was like, wow, this is really dumb. What am I going to do? Because I'm miserable. I don't like doing this, you know, not overall. I mean, I like the people I worked with some great people at First National, and I was challenged intellectually by finance, but you know, it wasn't me. It wasn't part of my it wasn't a part of my natural aptitudes or my DNA for, you know, if one is to believe that we're all, you know, put on this earth to do something. I was suddenly looking in the mirror going, you were not put on this earth to become a credit analyst.
Were you a credit analyst when you were playing semi-pro football for the Baltimore Eagles?
Yes, I was. I played. And it's funny, they were a semi-pro team, and I think the season I played, which was, let me think of this correctly, so it was
82?
82 was the fall of 82, that's right. That was the first year they became a quote-unquote minor league football team. And they were called the Baltimore Eagles because they got equipment from, and they wore colors similar to the Philadelphia Eagles. I think the Philadelphia Eagles had the first right of, you know, looking at anybody that might be talented enough who, you know, didn't go to college but wanted to play football and had skills that were good enough to be invited to an NFL camp. I think that's why there was some connection between the Baltimore Eagles and the Philly Eagles. And
we played a lot of Pennsylvania teams like Chambersburg and
yep,
and too. So we were right in the
that's right
being yeah, a minor league.
The bulk of the games affiliate were up in Pennsylvania, you know. I remember there was one game in a prison in Delaware, which was very interesting.
Really?
But the bulk was like oil fields and small towns in Pennsylvania. And guys that, for the most part, you know, working blue-collar jobs and, you know, had been really good athletes, but, you know, wanted to keep playing. And it was interesting. I mean, we had a 295-pound nose tackle from the University of Pittsburgh. And then we had guys who were straight out of high school. Like, we had a middle linebacker, must have been 5'7", 210 pounds. You know, it was like, you know, he wasn't nearly tall enough to play in the NFL, but he sure could play. He was a great player, you know, for semi-pro or whatever, minor league.
Sure. How did you get into that? How did you find out about the Eagles?
You know, I'd heard about them, and then I asked someone who, you know, was like a friend of a friend who said, you know, this is how you get in touch with them. And I just went and asked for a tryout because and they were like, but didn't you just play? I said, yeah, I played in all my life. I didn't play in college, but I played lacrosse. I had been a linebacker in high school. I must have been the slowest, biggest, whitest cornerback in the league. And so I played a little corner quarterback and a little and a more strong safety, you know. And we practiced. I remember we practiced just like club lacrosse. You practiced like two nights a week, and then you would play the games on usually on a Saturday night or, you know, Friday night sometimes.
So did you play club lacrosse?
Yep. Played for MLC, Maryland Lacrosse Club, and we won the club championship in 1982, in the spring of 82. We beat LI, beat the Long Island Athletic Club for the first time ever. So well, that was a legendary team. They had Jim D'Arcangelo on it, and
they were a terrific
Kevin Mahan was our goalie. Mark Greenberg was one of our leading defensemen. We had on the attack, we also had Dave Cottle, who you know was the time coach at University of Maryland, and Bobby Grebe was the attackman. And then Grebe and D'Arcangelo had been teammates since Towson State, and we had great players on that team. Joey Gold from UMBC is like the fastest guy in the league, and Howard Offit from Hopkins, who was my running mate and probably the best face-off man in all of club senior year at Hopkins. He was the best face-off man in the nation and at the collegiate level. So we had great players at every position. And, you know, we beat Long Island Athletic Club pretty decisively for the club championship.
How long did you play club lacrosse?
You know, just that one season. I think the following season I had run like on the second midfield that year. And then all of a sudden they had a bunch of graduates come in. You know, all I remember was I was miserable at the bank in 1983. I knew I needed to find a career, and I just felt like I didn't have the time for it. And then I was like running on the fourth midfield or something, and I didn't want to go to another team. And so I just said, you know what? At the time, there was no professional lacrosse. I knew I wasn't going to play the rest of my life. And I said, even though I'd had a great season the year before and had a great time playing with the fellas, I just thought, you know, I was so scared that I would not find what it is I was going to do for the rest of my life. And I just said, you know what, I gotta focus on going back to night school, which is what I was doing. The reason I couldn't practice at night was because I was in school.
What were you taking in night school?
Taking fiction writing and journalism. So I was in class, you know, two, three nights a week at Hopkins, ironically.
Do you think that if there was professional lacrosse at that time that you would have joined that up?
Oh, I would have tried. Yeah. I would have attempted to, absolutely. Yeah, because, you know, I think one of the things that I was angry about, you know, through all my fear, I was very angry, is that I had trained my entire life to play a game at a very high level. And unlike, you know, football and basketball and baseball players, ice hockey players, I could not go on to cash in on that. And, you know, not that professional lacrosse players make a living. There are very few that make a living playing lacrosse professionally.
You know, but it's something you knew how to do and you did it well. So yeah, it was a natural progression to go into it.
There had been a professional box league, and box is a whole different animal. But if you're big and you have strength, it's a good game because it's inside of an ice hockey rink, you know, and so it's a smaller, it's not so much speed and quickness as it is stick work and strength. And you have to be quick still, but you have to be strong and big enough to take a pounding. It's a game where you really, you know, get smashed into the boards a lot. But yeah, I would have attempted it. I don't know if I would have made it, but, you know, I certainly would have attempted it.
So you took night classes in writing and journalism, and then you had a class in acting. How did you pursue that?
I remember I took two classes. One was an introduction to acting class that I remember was on North Charles Street on the second or third floor of this big building, and it was just an open space. And I really fell in love the first night. And then the next semester, I took an on-camera class that met in a space that was opposite the Baltimore Dance Center that you see just off the Jones Falls Expressway. Mm. And it was, although I knew right away that I really liked acting and I thought I could be good at it. And, but when I did that on camera class and we did a scene, I remember all my classmates in a sort of an unsolicited way said, you know, you really should try and do this. You know, you're very relaxed and you see, you're very natural, and you know, you should try it. You know, and I got a lot of encouragement from other people, and I made up my mind. I took another job that paid me a little bit more money because I didn't have any savings, and I knew I needed a few thousand dollars to move to New York. But I made up my mind to move to New York, which I did in February of 1985. I spent most of 1984 managing an office in the Deep South in Alabama for a mortgage banking company, and then moved.
Was that
back.
Fun? Was that you fun?
Know. No, no, it wasn't fun. It was an education in life.
Sure.
It was really interesting. I was living in a trailer in a cornfield in a little town called Dothan, outside a little town called Dothan, Alabama, which is in the extreme. It's in such extreme, approximate southeast corner of the state of Alabama. You literally used to drive 5 minutes east and you were in Georgia. And if you drove 5 minutes south, you were in Florida. That's how nestled in the corner of the state it was.
It was a lot different from Jacksonville.
Oh, wow. And, yeah, and
same bucolic.
Bucolic. Bucolic was being kind. I mean, a lot of dirt roads, red clay roads that I used to drive down looking at meeting my appraiser to go over an appraisal on a double wide trailer on cinder blocks, you know. So one of those things.
How did you get
but
down there?
It was a
there?
Real education. You met a lot of people. I met a lot of my customers were all lower middle class, lower class customers because it was a finance company and refinancing homes and doing second mortgages and.
How did you get down there? How did this happen?
A couple of my ex-teammates were working for the company, and one of them said he'd wanted to hire me for some time. And I said, I don't want to, I'd have to be willing to travel. And he said, you have to be willing to travel because we're going to stick you in an office where we need you. And most of their offices were in the southeast. Maryland was the northernmost state I remember at the time, but they had offices in South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, I think Virginia, and Delaware, and they had a need in Montgomery, Alabama. I went and did a little bit of training in Columbia. It's Columbia, South Carolina. And then I got transferred because they had a need and they had lost a manager in Montgomery. And then the guy in Montgomery, I went with my boss, my immediate boss, and he said that Montgomery has a satellite office in this small town down in Dothan, and I need you to go down there and take care of that office. So it was like being shot out of a gun. I don't think I knew half of what I needed to know, but I sure got educated real fast because if you couldn't solve the problems, they would have fired me, you know. So they, you just had to learn how to get things done on your feet. And there's a lot to be said for, learning on your feet and applying it to whatever comes next in your life. You know, it's everything is preparation for the next thing.